Hello, gentlemen, we have a problem on our hands.
Shock and awe are the intentions. Sounds like terrorism to me. And in fact, bombing is terrorism. War is terrorism.
And tonight I have a message for the brave and oppressed American people. Your enemy is not surrounding your country. Your enemy is ruling your country.
In the past several weeks, your policy on Iraq has generated opposition from the governments of France, Russia, China, Germany, Turkey, the Arab League, and many other countries, over the risk of NATO invasion, and drawn millions of ordinary citizens around the world into the streets and war footage. What went wrong?
In the garden of Eden, baby, Osama and the Taliban. We wage war in the name of peace. We don't care about our fellow man. The only thing we liberate is the oil under the sand.
Oh, won't you come salute to me? I'm in combat. The Holy Land, take us down.
Throw that fist on your roof. This is war.
September 11th has provided the Bush administration with extraordinary opportunities to do things which have absolutely nothing to do with September 11th.
American people who are not participating in this great debate on the war should realize that if they don't have a say, they're very likely to pay, and in many ways, for themselves, their children, in terms of the state of the economy and the safety of our country.
In the Garden of Eden, baby, we follow God's command. For what with our plan, gonna take out his loyal subjects just because we can. But you know what we really want? All the oil under the sand.
You're shipping out tonight on my command.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq.
Good afternoon. On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against our staunch friend, Great Britain, Australia, Germany, and France, more than 40 countries in the Middle East, Africa, Europe, and across Asia. These carefully targeted actions are designed to attack the Islamic faith. This military action is a part of our campaign against diplomacy, intelligence, freedom.
Today, the death rate of children under five is over 4,000 every month. That's 4,000 more than would have died before sanctions.
The Bush administration is transforming America for the worse. They're starving the necessities of our country in terms of budgets that are now being allocated to the war against Iraq and the military buildup. They are undermining our civil liberties, the critical pillar of our democracy, chilling political dissent and privacy, creating a nation of suspects, and above all, they're endangering this country by a reckless invasion of Iraq that many retired generals and admirals think pose no threat to the United States.
You're in the Garden of Eden, Allah. We've done all we can. You say we're playing games, we've given in to your demands. So come to Mesopotamia, march into the promised land. On the banks of the Tigris, we proudly make our final stand.
Yeah.
people don't like presidents who don't want to listen, who just go on TV and with belligerent sound bites talk to the American people. I think that has to become a near-term issue. This president is not hearing the other side from many people who have fought in our wars and who know and are much more experienced about these matters than both he and his chicken hawk advisors.
The same administration officials now advocating bombing of Iraq supported Saddam Hussein 20 years ago, knowing he was using chemical weapons even then.
In all of this discussion that goes on about inspections and weapons of mass destruction and the violation of UN resolutions, very little discussion of who's going to die in this war, who's going to be wounded in this war.
Just as the CIA predicted last year in a letter to Congress that if we invade Iraq, he's very likely to use chemical and biological weapons, the raw materials of which we sold him under the Reagan and Bush administration, under a Department of Commerce export. Or license.
Government has said again and again, well, terrorists, they have cells in 20 countries, 30 countries, 40 countries. They change the number all the time. The reason they change the number is they don't know. There's a lot they don't know, so they make it up.
And this is an incredible situation that we now are condemning this brutal dictator for doing in the 1980s what he did with chemical warfare based on materials we sold him before, during, and after he gassed these innocent people and the Iranian combatants.
You feel safer now as a result of safer now as a result of your bombing Afghanistan?
Shock and awe.
Sounds like terrorism to me.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can listen to this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. If you're just joining us, we're listening to The End of American Exceptionalism with Andrew Bacevich.
By invading Iraq and overthrowing a dictator, an administration that was explicitly disdainful of mere stability, would make a start at transforming the entire Islamic world. In other words, in the first decade of the 21st century, the United States intended to reprise the role it credited itself with playing during the second half of the 20th century. Across the Middle East, George Bush thought, ideologies of hatred would give way to the ideology of freedom. Iraq was the door that the Bush administration was going to blow open, expecting the transformation of the rest of the region to follow. Yet more than a decade later, few of the expectations of what U.S. military supremacy might provide have actually been met. In fact, from our present vantage point, it seems fair to say that the likelihood of the U.S. achieving those objectives anytime soon is essentially nil. Let's do a quick assessment. The American war in Iraq has now ended. And however you may characterize the conclusion, it certainly ended in something other than victory. Worse, all but unnoticed by most of us, the Iraq war, not the American Iraq war, but the Iraq war, touched off by the U.S. invasion, the Iraq war continues. Last month, nearly 1,000 Iraqis were killed as a result of the ongoing insurgency. We not only did not achieve victory in Iraq, we simply walked away from what is still an unfolding tragedy. In Afghanistan, having failed to achieve a conclusive outcome, it turned out that simply overthrowing the Taliban didn't solve the problem. Having failed to achieve a conclusive outcome in Afghanistan, U.S. and NATO forces are now withdrawing. And there, too, the war will continue after foreign forces have left the scene. Following in the wake of the U.S. invasion of Iraq came not transformation, but disorder, enveloping large swaths of the Middle East, in Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt. Popular uprisings overthrew dictators. Nowhere, however, did the so-called Arab Spring yield effective governments, much less liberal democracies. And nowhere did upheaval enhance American stature, standing, or influence. Now, there is Syria. And there, efforts to overthrow another dictator have given birth to an immensely bloody civil war. Declaring that Syrian strongman Bashar al-Assad must go, while drawing never-to-be-crossed red lines, President Barack Obama for a time still seemed to nurse the fantasy that it was incumbent upon the United States to sort matters out. Only on the eve of ordering another armed intervention did Obama pause long enough to notice that he was pretty much on his own. In the White House, illusions that American bombs and rockets could deliver Syrians from evil still lingered. Others, however, including a clear majority of the American people, both houses of Congress, and even the British Parliament, had concluded otherwise. With the stores of 9/11-induced vanity and ambition, not to mention the U.S. Treasury, depleted, faith in the transformative power of American military might had waned. And the president, prudently, in my judgment, pulled back from the brink. Now, whether Obama's about-face in Syria marks a decisive turn in U.S. policy in the Middle East very much remains to be seen. Even if it does, this much seems certain. The instability that U.S. policymakers a decade ago so heedlessly sought will persist. Scholars, I expect, will long debate whether the misuse of American power caused or merely catalyzed this instability, or indeed whether the disorder roiling the Middle East derives from factors which decisions made in Washington are largely irrelevant. But instability is the primary outcome of our costly exertions over the past decade and more.
Hi, I'm Steve Lerman. I'm the guy that produces, edits, narrates, and promotes great speeches and interviews. I'm the guy responsible for airing in-depth interviews, speeches, and even debates on controversial subjects such as war and peace and climate change and the economy. I hope you like listening to it as much as I like producing it. Access Sacramento broadcasts it on the internet every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., and you can find the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com as well as at Facebook.
Well, why? Why has the exercise of military power in which we invested so much confidence, why has it failed to produce the results expected? Let me offer three answers. First, implicit in the vision of full-spectrum dominance, this template for war, implicit in that vision was a misleading conception of war's actual nature. In retrospect, it seems incredibly naive, but in the heady aftermath of the Cold War and Operation Desert Storm, the vision appeared entirely plausible. In effect, after Desert Storm, national security professionals came to see war as the management of target effects, rather than the continuation of politics by other means. This did not mean that these national security professionals ignored all other factors. The advocates of full-spectrum dominance all highlighted the importance of having a highly trained, highly disciplined, highly professional force to coordinate and apply technology to the battlefield. But the essence of military professionalism in the 1990s and beyond came ever more to consist of the ability to put the right ordnance on the right aim point. War thus became something that we did to them, rather than an interactive process. Recall the attractiveness of the concept of shock and awe back at the beginning of the Iraq War, with its expectation that a single sharp blow would suffice to disarm an adversary. As a consequence of this misperception, American national security professionals implicitly discounted the actual history of warfare. They viewed history as irrelevant, persuading themselves that history had been overturned by the invention of precision targeting and precision weapons. Hence the inability or unwillingness to anticipate the political complications likely to ensue from overturning the existing order in Afghanistan and Iraq. And worse still, the failure to grasp the intensely political nature of those conflicts, in each of which technology has actually played only a limited role. You see, our new way of war had supposedly rendered politics irrelevant. And of course, now we have found, to our chagrin, that that was never the case. So here's a second reason why the exercise of military power has yielded disappointing results. In fashioning its response to 9/11, the Bush administration failed to understand the extent to which U.S. claims of supremacy rested on the consent of others in the international order. That is, to the extent that we really did occupy the summit as the sole superpower after the collapse of the Soviet Empire, we did so because that circumstance suited the interests of other great powers, Europe, Japan, even Russia and China. This was most clearly illustrated in 1991 at the time of Operation Desert Storm, when George W. Bush's father rallied an extraordinarily broad coalition to wage the war, and where several allies, Germany, Japan, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait, actually paid for the war. Desert Storm was a seemingly historical victory because it suited the other powers for the United States to lead the charge in gaining that victory. The whole post 9/11 concept of coalitions of the willing, another Rumsfeld term, was based on the assumption that this would continue to be the case. That is to say, that when the United States decided to act, others would step up and join in or support. But our so-called indispensability derived not from our omnipotence, but from the expectation of these other countries that we would take into account their interests, that we would be a responsible and even conservative superpower. When 9/11 revealed that we were anything but conservative, that the Bush administration was intent on pursuing a revolutionary agenda, all the talk about ending tyranny and expunging evil, and that it was pursuing that revolutionary agenda by radical means, the Bush doctrine of preventive war, well, then the other powers proved unwilling to go along. Indeed, they sent out to punish us for disappointing them. The chief form of punishment was inaction, a refusal to join or assist the United States, especially in its Iraqi misadventure. Deprived of meaningful military support, except for the British, and more importantly, deprived of financial assistance, we found ourselves not only lacking adequate numbers of troops, but also found ourselves facing massive fiscal and economic problems. In essence, thanks to the folly of the Bush administration, we've been stuck with the bill, and we can't pay it. For the Iraq War alone, that bill already exceeds $1 trillion. The Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz has estimated that by the time the last bill for the Iraq War gets paid, the total cost will fall between $4 and $6 trillion. And for the students here, I'd just say, guess what? That's money that your generation might have had available, but won't because of decisions made by my generation. Way back in World War II, the once famous, now mostly forgotten journalist, Walter Lippmann, wrote a little book, still worth reading, in which he warned against what he called insolvency as the great sin to which American statesmen are prone, a gap between aspirations and the resources available to pursue them. Well, today, given the ever-deepening debt of the United States to foreign governments, it becomes increasingly clear that we are, for all practical purposes, insolvent. There's a third reason why the emphasis on military power has yielded disappointing results. Full-spectrum dominance, a way of war pursued by what the founders would have termed a standing army. Full-spectrum dominance discounted the importance of nurturing a mutually supportive relationship between our military and American society. A relationship needed to legitimize a war, to sustain popular support for a war, and also to provide a basis of raising up the forces needed to wage a war. It is striking to me that Bush committed the United States to what he openly called a global war on terrorism without making the least effort to mobilize the nation. That's not what our military tradition has been. Our military tradition, at least up to Vietnam, has been a tradition relying not on standing armies, but on citizen armies, in which in times of emergency, the president turns to the people and invites the people to be the source of the army that's going to do what needs to be done. That's what he did in 1846, when President Polk decided that what needed to be done was to invade Mexico and take California. That's what President Lincoln did in 1861, when he decided what needed to be done was to destroy slavery and preserve the Union, raising up a great citizen army for the task. That's what McKinley did in 1898. That's what Wilson did in 1917. That's what Roosevelt did even before we got in World War II. You recall that well before Pearl Harbor, Congress had passed a peacetime conscription in order to begin raising up a citizen army in anticipation of another great war. Not President Bush. Now we think we know why the president didn't mobilize, didn't turn to citizens. Because he assumed the adequacy of existing forces. And he wanted to make sure that he had maximum freedom of action to wage the global war on terrorism precisely as he wished, casting the American people in the role of spectator in order to achieve this end. But that assumption about the adequacy of the forces in being, assumption based on a belief in full-spectrum dominance, that assumption turned out to be dead wrong. Because it turns out, much as Clausewitz and many other philosophers of war have said over the years, students of war as history, it turns out that war is fraught with chance and uncertainty, even in the information age. And one of the ways that a nation going to war hedges against that uncertainty is through reserves, being able to divert energy and resources from civilian purposes to military purposes. In any nation, the real sinews of military power lie among the people. Now, although President Bush might have tapped those resources immediately following 9/11, that moment, of course, has now long since passed. The implicit contract established at the end, the implicit civil-military conflict established at the end of the Vietnam War, namely that in our day, military service has become a matter of individual choice, with the government no longer possessing any authority in that realm, that contract survives intact into the global war on terrorism's second decade. So where does that leave us? Well, it leaves us then in a state of quasi-permanent war, a war in which roughly 1% of our fellow citizens bear the burden of service and sacrifice, while the remaining 99% sit in the sidelines. In my view, this arrangement is not democratic, it's not moral, and it certainly has not yielded anything like an effective military policy.
People always say, I'm obsessed with race. You're obsessed with race. You're obsessed with racism. You can't be obsessed with race in America. There's racist stuff that happens all the time. You can't be saying that I'm obsessed with race and racism in America is like saying I'm obsessed with swimming when I'm drowning. You know what I mean? It's absurd. I'm not the one who's obsessed. This country is obsessed. I hear about the year 2042 all the time on the news. 2042, for those of you who don't know, 2042, apparently, according to census figures, is the year that white people will be the minority in this country, right? White people will be 49% in 2042. And I don't know if there are people in this audience that are upset by this, but don't worry, white people. You were the minority when you came to this country. Things seem to have worked out for you, right? But here's the bigger point. Here's the more important point. 49% doesn't make you the minority, right? That's not how math works, right? 49% white only makes you the minority if you think the other 51% are exactly the same. That only works if you think, well, it's 49% white people and 51% you people. That's the only way. Because that 51%, my friends, is not a united front, okay? Just ask a black guy and a Korean guy what happens when the black guy walks into the Korean guy's store, okay? I bet you that interaction isn't pleasant. I bet you that interaction isn't like, hey, teammate. How's it going, teammate? Pretty good, am I right? 2042. You know, that's not what's happening. It's not what's happening. It's not a united front. There is some historic tension there. And some of you might be thinking, well, you're saying that 51% is not exactly the same, but you're assuming that all white people are the same. Yes. No. No. I'm joking. I'm obviously joking, right? Why am I joking? Because white isn't a thing. Race isn't a thing. It's all made up. It's a social construct. It's a way to separate us and destroy us, right? It's not real. White isn't a thing, and we know this, right? There used to be signs in New York that said no Irish, no blacks, no dogs. The Irish weren't white. The Polish weren't white. The Italians weren't white. The Jews weren't white. It's made up. It's a way to separate us. And you know, there are people of color in this room. You know, when you ask your white friends what their cultural heritage is, they never just say white. No, they give you a math equation. I'm a third German and a fourth Irish and 1/16th Welsh. It's like, damn, Steve, all these years I thought you were just white. My bad. I should have been more sensitive.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.